I didn't know if anyone wanted to had any questions or anything from the talk. Yeah.
So is it possible to direct the attention to what we call the citta?
Yes. Yes, there's actually a teaching in the suttas where the great monk Anuruddha goes to Sariputta and talks about, he's known as the foremost in psychic powers and foremost in mindfulness and foremost in almost everything. He was like an incredible practitioner. So he goes to Sariputta and says, I'm foremost in all these things. I'm sort of paraphrasing and shortening it now, partly because I can't remember the whole list. but I still suffer. So I'm still suffering. Like, I've all these accomplishments. And Sariputra said, it's partly to do with your sense of self-conceit and your restlessness that you're experiencing. You're still looking for something more, maybe, or that sense of self. And then he said to Anuruddha, turn your mind to the deathless. Turn your mind to the deathless. So the attention that's going out into the objective world, that manovijnana that's creating and generating that separative consciousness, that's the training. At first you're training vipassana, you're training it to slow down and look at those objects like the frames of the movie and seeing them through the lens of anicca, dukkha, anatta, etc., that whole ten. But eventually, in the Chan or the Zen or the turn your mind, it comes out of the Theravada, the turn your mind to the deathless or the signless, anudasana, vijnana, the signless consciousness. You can't find a sign or a letter, it's not. But you start to, in the Zen they call it the great return, starting to turn the mind back into. And so for that, sometimes some different methodologies are helpful. Like the question who, is like who's thinking. And, so you're not just looking at the object of thought. It's like you're exploding the whole kind of premise of me looking, who's witnessing. So you start, it's like an inquiry, like the koan. It's not so much looking for the answer, but it's just to stop the momentum. And it's a moment of recognition of the awareness. Or the instruction to Bahia that the Buddha gave in the seen is just the seen, the heard is just the heard, the thinking is another way of going to the non-dual. The contemplation of another way in is, our teacher used to talk about Ajahn Sumedho. In London, because we were trained in the monasteries in the UK, when you get on the tube train, like your subway, it goes, when you step up, it goes, mind the gap. He used to teach mind the gap, that there's always gaps. It's like in the Matrix, you're in the mind. It's like, but there's gaps, there's loads of gaps, and there's loads of inconsistencies. When you look at the mind, it's a little crazy. It's full of inconsistencies and holes and gaps, and you start to notice that. And so what's in the gap? And rather than fill it up, you increase the gap. Gaps between thoughts, gap between here and there. Another one is, just looking, like he would train you to, when you go into a room like this, you look at all that, how many people, what people, who's here, do I know them, don't I know them, all the rest, the way we define everything. But it's all happening in the space. Do you notice the space? So the space never changes, but the content changes. So we're so obsessed with the content. It's like the mind is so obsessed with the content. Like the forest master Ajahn Tate taught, to notice the difference between mind and the activity of mind. To notice the space is like noticing the jitta or the awareness. So noticing the awareness. And eventually that, who's noticing begins to, that's like the stepping stone. And that starts to dissolve, just awareness. So there's definitely methods to turn that, back the mind. And it kind of gets pretty interesting. And it's, Something we can practice, actually, regardless of what's going on. You know, another method that our teacher used a lot was listening to sound. And interestingly enough, although he didn't teach it in that context, that is Kuan Yin's method of awakening. Listening to sound, and what's called, like, if in the sutta it says, if sound disappears, does the listening disappear? You know, so there's sound, and then maybe that sound, but there's still the listening. So it's like, if the content dissolves, does the awareness collapse? No. There's still that which is. You know, that which is. And so we're recognizing there's that which is. You know, it's not dependent on the conditions. Therefore, it's called the unconditioned. It's not dependent on stuff being there, it just is. So when the Buddha talked about himself, he named himself the Tathagata, the one that's dwelling in such, in isness. That's how he most talked about himself. And I think that's really gives us a clue as well, suchness. So it's like, you know, it's always that here and now. So, you know, or my partner Kittisara likes to use the koan, what remains? What's always here? What remains? And there's all, you know, getting on the subway, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, I'm going to work, and then listening to the news, I'm getting all sort of very reactive about the news, and so on, but what remains? And you can contemplate that, you can contemplate in the moment, you can contemplate as a theme, what remains when the world system dies, you know, from that level right to what remains when this thought disappears. So there's quite loads of ways into that contemplation of turning the mind to the deathless. Yeah. Great question. Mm. Yes.
So, my question is about Vimasitara Sarvidharma, yielding deliverance as essence, as all things. Yeah. And I am asking if there is a practice in this piece around oppression, and it's kind of like what I understand that you say is that all things are already free, and how do I see when that's not always so?
No, it's not always so, but it can be so in terms of, this is a internal experience. It's not a spiritual bypass about the state of the world and saying it's already free. It's clearly not. There's massive amounts of oppression and inequality, and that needs to be addressed. And we'll look at that tomorrow more. But even if you are, you know, like in the most oppressed experience, or the most suffering experience, there is a way that you can be with that, where you're not suffering, adding to the suffering. You know, that by recognizing that there is that, you know, it's a bit like you can do what you like to me, but ultimately there's that which that will never die. There is that which always is. There is that which is already free. You know, and when you're in touch with that, and when we look at the great heroes of the people that have struggled against massive oppression, partly why they've been able to do what they've done, because they're so in touch with that underlying truth, and they can bring that forward, you know, and that sort of transcends even the fear of death. Or, but, you know, that's the higher practice. You know, I look at, say, Mr. Mandela in South Africa, and what he was able to produce as a consciousness, you know, that came through 27 years more of through the fire of what he went through, that he distilled. You know, like, it's a story that, for example, after his freedom, and when he was Prime Minister of South Africa, he came to a town near where we were guiding teachers for many years in KwaZulu-Natal. And we know this story from one of the bodyguards that was that lives near to us now, where Dhammagiri is. And this particular town, there was a lot of turf wars between the African National Congress, the ANC, and the Inkatha Freedom Zulu Party, which were generated and inflamed by the apartheid government. You know, so it was divide and rule strategy, but it was still basically a low-grade war. And when we arrived in South Africa, that wasn't exactly at its height, but it was still going on. You know, our first retreat in the village near us, there were, you know, it was over Christmas, Twitching Christmas retreat, and over 100 people in that skirmish were killed. So it was very real violence going on. And he was, there was one particular town that was ruled quite near us, that was ruled by the head of this like mafia guy, really, of this Inkatha Freedom Party. And they had been killing the ANC members. And so Mr. Mandela wanted to visit this town. And his whole security detail said, we'll take you there in a bulletproof car, but you cannot get out and walk through this town. I mean, they were really frightened that he would be shot and killed. And apparently he turned around to them and said, well, what use is my freedom if I can't walk in my own country? So he asked to be taken there. He got out the car and he walked down the road. And the whole, you know, apparently his presence was something to behold. You know, the quality of his presence was extraordinarily regal and also like a darshan, a tremendous sense of presence and strength. And you could feel it come into a room. And I've been in a room with him with 1,000 people, so maybe not that many, but like everyone just goes like to a magnet, that quality of presence. And he walked through that town and the whole place just, like the Buddha would call it, the stilling of Sankara. The whole thing was, you know. That is the product of someone that learnt freedom in the heart of oppression, but also generated that bodhicitta and took it out into a violent, divided world. And for a moment on the world stage held something. You know, it wasn't, you know, it's those karmas don't get resolved, because that's that's the power of karma. There's still a lot that he couldn't heal. It's too big. But those examples are important for us. You know, those examples that even in the midst of suffering, coming up from our own process or imposed externally, we don't have to suffer from the suffering. And it doesn't mean to say that we're not going to act to alleviate the oppression. You know, that clearly the Buddha acted. You know, he did a lot of alleviation of oppression at systemic levels, not just internally sit there and meditate. But it, you know, it is a complex question, because it can sound like, you know, it doesn't matter, you just be free internally and leave the world to, you know, leave. Don't deal with. That's not. I don't think that's a complete message. I don't think it really reflects the Buddha's actual life and what he was, the precedent he set through his example.
I had a question about, you use the word radiance.
Mm.
I struggle sometimes because I've had a lot of background with Dzogchen Tibetan aspects, so that sort of way of seeing things is pretty strong. And I've read the suttas a lot, and I think that word, the luminous nature, it's the miracle discourse is one time that I've had not anywhere else, so I kind of sometimes feel like I'm trying to transpose one thing on the other. And I wonder, can you sort that out at all?
I think part of our difficulty is that we've read a lot of stuff, and it creates a lot of, I mean, it's good, we need to, because it helps point us to the territory, but then we have these ideas that superimpose on top of experience and realization. So obviously we want to get to the realization. I think these are just terms. You know, even the term Nibbana is just a word. It's not the actuality. And then they become bigger than the actual, what they're pointing to. So, you know, this is a term that comes out, the you know, it's one of the few terms that the Buddha talked about the nature of the citta, the unobstructed citta. He used the word pabhasara, which is means luminous or radiant. So it's you can't actually describe what awareness is. You know, you could say it's light, it's illuminating. You know, you could say it's illuminating what it's looking at. You know, so it's, you know, when you're illuminating the, you know, dukkha, or you're illuminating, you know, through, so you know, in that way. But you can't really say, you know, it's like you think of a light, or, you know, that's just an analogy. You know, so actually, when we say turn to the mind of the deathless, we're going to have to go beyond the cognitive, you know, and all of those forms and metaphors that we've been working with, Tibetan to Theravada and so on. So I think the point is let's see if we can actually practice to taste this ourselves. Yeah. You could say that the deep depth of the dark mystery, you know, the prajna, you know, that's another way of talking about the unknowing reality, the unconditioning reality. You know, it's not without intelligence in it. It's not without, you know, wisdom. You know, it's dynamic intelligence, but it's precognitive. So, you know, so in that way, it's like looking into the depth of the night, infinite sky at night. You know, you could also say it's like infinity. You can't really put a description on it. You know, so these are like metaphors, really, for what is beyond metaphor. So I think in a way, when we're practicing, we take what helps us. You know, some people find this metaphor helpful, another that one. You know, but as long as we understand that they're pointers, not the actual direct realization, then we should be okay. Mm. Yes. Yes. He's just saying about Ajahn Chah eating the banana. Yeah. You got to eat the banana ourselves. And on that note, maybe we should finish the evening. Yeah, because I think we reached our limit. So we'll see you, hopefully some of you tomorrow. If you can join us, it'd be great. Seb will join us, and we'll plunge deeper into this territory, or more into this territory. Yeah. Good night, everyone. Thank you so much. It's great to meet you.